Yeah. Accession number 3 hours 639. Mr. Alan Davis, Reel 11. Now, where do you go to next then? Because you're there till the end of July, and then where do you go next?
Well, these dates I'm giving you are dates in my logbook. I might well have gone to these places a week or two before and not actually flown, but I can only be accurate by looking at my logbook. And so, to my great joy, having not liked it very much at this place, Atcham, because I found it not a very friendly sort of place to be, to my great joy, I had another posting then to number 61 Operational Training Unit, 61 OTU, which was at Keevil.
Now, where's Keevil?
Keevil is near Trowbridge, and Trowbridge is near Swindon. But it's Wiltshire.
Well, oh, it's Wiltshire.
I thought it was Gloucestershire when we set off to go there, but we discovered, thanks to the railway porter, that Trowbridge was in Wiltshire. And to my great joy, when we got to Trowbridge and to Keevil, we discovered that they'd got Spitfires and Mustangs. So we knew that's what we were due to fly, and we didn't know till we reported whether we were either which of those we were going to fly. But I had opted some time back for day fighter aircraft if I could.
Now, what was the choice given to you, and why did you choose day fighter?
I suppose because it was the best alternative. You could have had twin engine, and I would then have to go on a conversion course for twin engines, day fighters, night fighters, and that sort of thing. And one of the options was single engine day fighters. So I chose that. Little did I know that in fact meant probably to go to a tactical reconnaissance, fighter reconnaissance operational training unit, which this one turned out to be. And I'm so pleased that we were on a fighter reconnaissance training schedule rather than a straight fighter schedule. The Mustangs were straight fighters, and I've met up with quite a number of ex-pilots from there since. But the Spitfires were the fighter reconnaissance unit, and we were split off into little flights or squadrons. I suppose it was called a squadron. Just looking up to find out what number it was. It was called. Which I don't have.
Don't worry.
Well, it just was called 61 OTU Keevil. And
now, so you were going to be... When did you find you were going for tactical reconnaissance training? Then, as soon as you got there?
As soon as we got there, yes.
And you were pleased?
Delighted, absolutely delighted.
Now, why? Because it is different from day fighter, slightly.
Well, I just thought it's what was the new term for the Army cooperation flights or units or whatever, and so one liaised very much with the Army during the whole of the training, and luckily again it meant that I went to a fighter reconnaissance squadron. But we arrived at Keevil, and I discovered that one other guy from Atcham was with me, and he was called Alan Griffith, and he turned out to be a great buddy. And we went through the whole of this 61 OTU together.
Now, what was he like, Alan Griffiths? He'd be a pilot officer. So
Well, he was a remustered airman. In other words, he sported an Africa Star medal ribbon because he had served as an engine fitter in North Africa. And he had remustered, as many people did, remustered and got selected to go to flying training, which he did in South Africa, and did all the sort of advanced flying units and things that I did. We finished up at Atcham together, where we hardly knew each other there, when we found ourselves on the same train going from Atcham down to Trowbridge. And neither of us had any idea what aeroplanes there were on the station. When you got there, you asked around and discovered what they flew. And we were, as I say, delighted to find that they'd got Spitfires and Mustangs.
Now, what was he like as a young lad then?
He was much the same size as me, very much more worldly wise, since he had been an airman and obviously served probably a year longer in the Air Force than me, at least a year. So he'd be slightly older, he'd be a year older than me. And we got on famously. He came from the Liverpool area when he was at, that was his hometown, so we'd never met before and we didn't have very much in common, except that we both liked flying and we both didn't land up at the same RAF station. And we got so that we had a few beers together and we flew together in separate aeroplanes, of course, quite a lot, actually. And he turned out to be a very, very good pilot, very much an above-average pilot, which I hadn't realised at the time, because I more or less kept pace with him, and I flew alongside him quite a lot. But apparently he was he had just this edge on an ability to fly, which some people had and some people didn't. But he was certainly an above-average pilot. Anyway, we got on famously, and we discovered that, to our joy, we reported to the to the flights, as they called them, the huts near where the aeroplanes were kept, because they were kept out in the open all the time. Then you went into a hangar to be serviced, and when we got there, we discovered that not only were they Spits, but they were Spitfire Mark 14s, which is by that stage of the game, very advanced mark of Spitfire. The one that I didn't fly at Atcham was a Spitfire 5. The ones which I subsequently flew in the squadron, which I'll come to later, of course, they were Spitfire 9s.
Now tell me, how do they start you with your training then? I mean, is it first learning to fly the Spitfire, or what?
No, it is presumed by the time you get to operational training unit that you are fairly competent at flying, and will adapt to flying a new plane like a Spitfire fairly readily. So you went through the usual cockpit checks, this blindfold business of being able to identify where the instruments, each instrument was, and on the control panel.
Now, what did the Spitfire 14 have? Do you remember now? I mean, you may not.
Well, one of the things the Spitfire 14 had that the others didn't have was a five-bladed propeller instead of a three- or a four-blade propeller. A five-bladed propeller, which was enormous. And the Mark 14 had, instead of having the ordinary Merlin engine, it had the much more higher powered Griffin engine, Griffon engine. And the clever buggers that ordained these things worked it so that the Griffin engine turned the propeller in the opposite direction to what had to which the Merlin engine did. So, as the Merlin engine had a tendency to swing to the left, the Griffin engine had a much more pronounced tendency to swing to the right, particularly on takeoff. And why I remember which way it swung was, we were briefed that not only did you have to have full left-hand trim on the rudder bar, I told you about the wheels just now, they had two wheels, a fore and aft trimmer wheel and a left and right trimmer wheel. Not only did you have to have full left-hand trim on the trim tabs, but you also had to have almost full left-hand rudder, and in other words, your left foot pushed right forward on initially on takeoff. Otherwise, the plane veered on the, just as it took off from the runway, veered to the right. Now, there were six of us in a flight, so the six of us went through the program together. And the six I was on, of which I have a photograph, and a very, very mixed bunch, the six in my flight all coped with this swing on takeoff perfectly well, because we were briefed properly and we listened, and we were able to carry out to do what we were told. In other words, we used full left hand rudder and the plane took off like a bird. I happened to, subsequently, some few weeks later, sitting in an aircraft talking to a group of other people about the inside of the aeroplane, and we watched the next flight take off, and one of them, two of them, one of them had a distinction of having taken off, just got the wheels off the ground, and the plane, he had not listened to the instruction, the plane veered almost 90 degrees to the right in the air at about 10 feet above ground level, which meant that he was heading for huts and sleeping quarters and officers' messes and all that sort of thing at about 10 feet above the ground with the wheels down and at full throttle, so that it made a hell of a noise and completely in the wrong direction, and he scared the daylight out of everybody, including himself. However, he managed to remedy that and got the plane to a respectable height and did his first solo or whatever, fine. But when he came down, I'm not sure whether it was that plane or another plane, but again, with this five-bladed propeller, which was probably, 12 or 15 foot in diameter, I mean, it was a colossal propeller. When you tip the nose forward when the wheel at the stern came up and it was in almost flying position, there was about 4 to 6 inches between the tip of the propeller and the concrete of the runway. So if you stuck the joystick, the control column, too far forward, the propeller would hit the concrete. And so either him or another chap also flying his first solo that day managed to file between 4 and 6 inches off the end of each of the propeller blades. So when he stopped the engine, there was this 15 foot, well, let's say something like that, long diameter propeller with about 6 inches missing off each propeller blade. And the answer was that when the plane was in the air, it ran very, very roughly and was barely able to, comfortably push the aeroplane along, but it certainly didn't go as fast as it should have done, and all its flying characteristics would have changed dramatically. So, but not many people did that, and stayed on the unit. It was quite possible to get the sack, in other words, just taken off the course and sent somewhere else or to do something else, because that almost ranked as a complete failure. But however, the flight I was on, we managed perfectly well and did our first solos in this absolutely gorgeous aeroplane.
Now, what was it like to fly then? Take me through it.
Well, they were, instead of, unlike the Hurricanes, which were very elderly, the Spitfire 14s were extremely new. They smelt inside like a new car, for example. You know, they smelt new. Everything about them was clean and polished and not covered in years' worth of stale oil and grime and stuff. I exaggerate because the planes weren't in that bad a condition ever. The the ground crew were so conscientious that they kept them up to the mark. But the difference between flying an aeroplane which was 2 or 3 years old and a Spitfire 14, which was probably had only 100 or 200 hours worth of flying on it, in it, was completely different. It's just like driving a new car, in other words. But they were extremely shiny and new and smelt new, and extremely powerful, much more powerful than the old Merlin engine ones. And they were absolutely beautiful. Whereas the others all started with a starter accumulator, or starter ACK, it was known as. In other words, a big battery or a motor-driven battery on wheels, which parked beside the older things like Hurricanes and the older Spitfires, and it's actually plugged into the engine for the starter, and when you start it up, it had to be unhooked, and the trolley ACK wheeled away out of the way of the aeroplane, whereas the Spitfire 14s had a Kaufman, spelt with a K, K-O-F-F-M-A-N starter, which was a cartridge, cartridge without a bullet, I suppose. It had an explosive charge which fired the engine and made the propeller spin, and the engine took up the power as soon as the propeller started to turn. So you had five or six cartridges in a fully equipped Spitfire 14. So you had 5 or 6 chances of starting, and if it didn't start with that number, the whole part of the engine cowling had to be taken off, and 6 more of these starter cartridges put in. So the propeller was so powerful that the plane would not start if the plane wasn't faced exactly into the wind. In other words, if it had any wind pressure on the propeller, which retarded its proper movement, it wouldn't catch, the engine wouldn't start. And so frequently the instructor or were still the old quadrennial in charge of the unit would come charging out and demand that the plane was put exactly into the wind before you wasted any more of these Kaufman starters. Anyway, that was, even starting it was different and difficult. But when the engine was started, it was the power behind the engine. And the throttle. Whereas the throttle on a normal aeroplane is in a V-shaped frame, and the throttle would move, let's say, six to 7 inches from fully closed to fully open. With the Spitfire 14, the throttle quadrant was certainly more than 90 degrees. It was 90 or 100 degrees in width and scope, so that the throttle closed had 10 or 12 inches to move before it was throttle fully open. And whereas the throttles in any other aeroplane that I'd ever flown were vertical, and you held them like that, with the Spitfire 14, they were angled so that the throttle lever was on the side rather than vertical, so horizontal, if you like. And that gives you some indication of the range of power between fully closed and fully open, or fully forward with a throttle. It was a colossal throttle movement, and it powered an enormously powerful engine. They used to say, jokingly, that it was all engine and no aeroplane, because it was certainly a couple of feet longer in fixed into the airframe, longer than a Merlin. So you had even more engine to look out over when you were, particularly when you were landing. But the jump from Harvard and Hurricane to the Spitfire 14 was a big jump, and it was most exciting because when the aeroplane got in the air, it was...
Now, what was it like, flying characteristics, as they call it?
Well, it was a really ladylike aeroplane. People who are very experienced said that it was not quite like all the other Spitfires. It was clumsier and harder work to manoeuvre with it than the previous Marks of Spitfire. I can't tell because I only flew the Spitfire 14 at OTU and then subsequently Mark 9s on the squadron, and I really couldn't have told you that the 14 was a difficult or a more difficult plane to fly to us on the operational training unit. And the great thing about the operational training unit was that they presumed you could fly. You didn't have to learn anything more about flying. What you did do at operational training unit was the photography, which you mentioned earlier.
Flying characteristics, stick to that. I want to come on. What was it actually like to fly?
Well, it was exciting. It was, a bit like sitting in a sports car when you've been used to flying to driving an ordinary family sort of car. Even from a Hurricane. It was infinitely more powerful than a Hurricane. It was infinitely lighter on the controls. It was as near perfection of flying as I can possibly imagine. I don't doubt there are other aeroplanes which have similar characteristics, but to us it was, I'd say, just like getting into a really powerful, souped-up, sort of Jaguar-type sports car, and it behaved just like that. It did everything more powerfully and more beautiful. To do a roll in one, this is what you wanted me to talk about, isn't it? To do a roll in one was absolutely dead easy, because the Mark 14s that we flew at this particular stage and on the squadron were the clipped wing versions, and they clipped the wings so that they were given added manoeuvrability. You lost a tiny bit of lift and so on, maybe, but the turning circle on it in a rolling type of movement. It could be so quick because it didn't have this extra 2'6" 3' of wingtip to get round. Its characteristic in a loop was much the same, except that because it had a heavier engine, once it started going downhill, it went downhill. It seemed to go downhill much quicker, and I suppose it did. Initially, give you an impression anyway of going downhill very, very fast indeed. But when we were pulling it up into a vertical climb, it climbed on full throttle. I went on climbing up. It was just magnificent machine, because it was so much engine, such a powerful engine to power, to pull. Comparatively light airframe, but to us, when we first started flying them, they were an absolute joy to fly.
Was it technically actually heavier than the Hurricane? It appeared light in flight, but you know, sometimes when you look at them, you think that's actually bigger. You know,
well, it might well physically have been bigger and heavier than a Hurricane, but because of the engine. And because it was a Spitfire and not a Hurricane, I guess.
The design.
It felt very much lighter to fly. And it was an absolute dream to fly. It responded so quickly, and if you manoeuvred it, it sort of bit back, because if you did anything too suddenly, it seemed to... They correct you if it was being mishandled. It didn't like being mishandled, but it responded to a more gentle touch. And if you knew what you were doing, you could get the most wonderful aerobatics and manoeuvres out of it. So we did. We learned how to handle it, of course, initially, and then we started learning how to apply our flying. And you mentioned the aerial photography. We did.
Now, hang on. What about landing? Because one thing about the Spitfire is it's not that easy to land, apparently, or it may be, but what about landing? Because the engine gets in the way.
Well, the engine gets in the way. I've told you about the, or I mentioned, the curved approach.
Was that essential with the Spitfire?
Well, yeah, absolutely essential, because if you tried a straight-on approach, which I suppose you had to do if you had engine trouble airframe trouble, if you'd been hit by anti-aircraft or another German plane or something and had part of it shot away, you might well have to make a straight approach. But that was not an easy way to land the Spitfire with that great big engine. It has, as I say, another couple of feet of engine stuck on the engine, because that meant that the airframe had to be redesigned. And the tail of the Spitfire 14 with the Griffin engine was quite a different shape to the previous marks of Spitfire. But although it might have looked heavier, it didn't behave as if it were a heavier aircraft. It certainly behaved as if it were a very ladylike, temperamental type creature. In other words, if you didn't land correctly, if you landed on one wheel first, it would rock, because the undercarriage was, the wheels were much closer together when the undercarriage was down than the Hurricane. The Hurricane wing wheels were farther out in the wing, farther away from the fuselage. So it was a demanding sort of plane. It required to be flown with care and accuracy, but it responded to correct treatment, correct flying ability, if you like, I think so wonderfully well. It was an absolute joy to fly, and of course the first solo was nothing like as traumatic as it would have been had you not had done a first solo in the Hurricane first. And so I was lucky, or we were lucky. Alan Griffiths and I were the same. We both flown a Hurricane before we had to climb into a Spitfire and do it. So the first solo in a Spitfire 14 could be quite exciting if you got it wrong. The swing on takeoff and the closeness of the tip of the propeller to the ground in a flying position. So and it was it demanded correct flying. And after all, we'd been quite a long time, and 250 odd hours of flying tuition to get to that state.
And your first solo was a success?
Yes and no. It was a success from a flying point of view, but when I got up in the air, I discovered that I couldn't close the canopy. Now, with all the other aircraft I'd flown, the canopy closed by putting a hand over your head, grasping the middle of the canopy, and then pushing it forward ahead of you, and it clicked into position. With the Spitfire 14, there was a little handle on the side, and I took off, great, fine, took off straight ahead, did a nice gentle turn to the left, which is the way you're supposed to do it. It wasn't until I got down on the ground several days later that some squadron leader said, was that you doing your first solo on Thursday afternoon on the 20-something, whatever? And I said, well, yes, it could have been. He said, well, you didn't see my formation that I was leading then, did you? And I said, no, I didn't. He said, I thought you wouldn't, because you're on your first solo. So I managed to steer the formation away from you so that we didn't alarm you. But I didn't know that until several days later. But coming back to this canopy,